Wake me up when it's time to go, Julia said, yawning. Sweet dreams, was Emmy's answer. She turned out the light and got into bed, turning her back to Julia so that her sister would not see that Emmy kept her eyes open. When Julia's breathing was slow and even, Emmy turned over, parted the blackout curtains, and watched her sister sleep in a spill of moonlight. She gazed up at the sky outside the window, thankful for the cloudless blanket of stars and generous moon. She did not mean to doze at all, but the next thing Emmy knew, the clock downstairs was chiming too. She sat up in bed, grateful it was only two and not later. Emmy could not risk falling asleep again. She got out of bed quietly and listened for any sounds in the house that would indicate that Rose or Charlotte was awake. Hearing nothing, Emmy slipped off her nightgown and stuffed it into the satchel. She dressed in the same clothes she had worn the day before, grabbed her jacket from the back of the desk chair, and bent to retrieve the satchel. When her knees straightened, an owl hooted outside their window, and Julia's eyes snapped open.
Is it time to go?
She whispered. Emmy's mind raced for a way out of this predicament. She had time. She could wait a little longer.
Not yet. Go back to sleep.
Julia sat up. She saw Emmy's made bed and that her big sister was in her street clothes.
Why aren't you still sleeping?
I just can't sleep anymore. Julia tossed her legs over the side of her bed.
Me neither. Jules, it's not time to go yet. But I'm not sleepy anymore.
As Emmy pondered her response, the voice of reason seemed to murmur just at the edge of sound that this was a moment that demanded she weigh the consequences, consider the possible outcomes. She stood at a crossroads, half aware that her choice would send her down a path from which there could be no turning back. But instead of two choices, she saw only one, because it was all she really wanted to see. Emmy mentally shooed the whispering voice away. She would look back on that moonlit night and wonder and wonder and wonder what she would have done had she considered that the owl that awakened Julia was divinely sent so that she wouldn't leave Thistle House that night. Had it been summoned to the tree outside the window and called her little sister out of sleep so that Emmy might stop and consider that there is always, always the other road to choose, even if it seems to be nothing more than an unpaved path in the middle of nowhere. On that night, the night Julia could not fall back asleep, Emmy saw only what she wanted to. All right, Emmy said, sighing as loud as she dared. Let's go then. Don't make a sound, Julia. Not a peep. As Julia dressed by moonlight and Emmy made her bed, Emmy decided she would take Julia straight to the flat. If Thea wasn't home, she'd tell her sister to wait for Mum to get home from work. Emmy would still have plenty of time to make it to Knightsbridge by 4. She would deal with Mum's anger later, if she had to. And as for Julia, well, Mum could easily get her sister back to Thistle House on Sunday. Easily. Mum had the address. She had the day off. She owed Charlotte a visit anyway. There was nothing to worry about. Emmy grabbed her satchel, and together she and Julia tiptoed soundlessly down the stairs, out the front door, and into the sparkling night. Chapter 15. Kendra. A rap at the door startles me, but Isabel merely turns her head toward the sound. The door opens slightly, and Beryl pokes her head inside the parlor.
Can I freshen the pot for you, ladies?
Her words are polite, but the tone and her facial expression are fraught with worry. I can see that she's concerned the interview is taking too long, that I'm exhausting Isabel, and potentially sabotaging the party.
I am quite happy with 2 cups I've had, Isabel replies without a moment's hesitation, or a hint of fatigue.
She turns to me.
Kendra, would you care for more tea?
No, I'm good, but thank you very much.
Isabel directs her attention back to Beryl.
You can take the tea tray, dear.
Beryl enters the room, her anxiety only slightly lessened as she hoists the tray.
Is there anything else I can get for you?
Are you needing to rest, Auntie? Do you want your medicine now?
No, but thank you. We're fine.
Beryl turns toward us before she leaves the room. If I can bring you anything else,
we'll be sure to let you know.
Don't worry about us.
You attend to the party details, Beryl.
Right then, Beryl says, obviously unconvinced as she closes the door behind her. I turn my attention back to Isabel. She doesn't exhibit signs of fatigue, and yet surely she must be tired after having talked without stopping for the last hour or so. I am thankful for the full charge of my recorder's battery. I have written nothing on my notepad, so spellbound have I been. From behind where Isabel sits, I see one of her Umbrella Girl paintings, and I know now where the polka dot umbrellas came from, though I don't know how. I only know that Isabel is somehow connected to the story she is telling me about the two sisters, one named Emmeline and the other Julia. Furthermore, we are sitting in Thistle House. Part of the story she is telling me happened right here in this room. Isabel inhales deeply, as if needing a fresh charge of oxygen to continue. I am about to ask her if she would like to take a break after all, when she speaks.
You, being a history major, probably know what these two sisters were headed into, don't you? It being the 7th of September.
I nod. The Blitz began that day. Isabel takes a handkerchief out of her skirt pocket and blots her nose, gently and with practiced gentility.
Indeed it did.
But Emmy couldn't have known that.
No, no, she could not.
She folds the handkerchief and places it on the table next to her. Then she laughs gently.
It is strangely amusing how proud Emmy was for getting herself and her little sister to Morton, in the dark, after carrying Julia when her feet and legs got tired. And then they had to hide in the ladies' room like mice, until the ticket office opened. Emmy had thought of a good excuse for needing train tickets to London while they walked. Not that it should have been anyone's business. But she knew the train station master would be curious. Children didn't travel to London those days. They left it. By the thousands. So she told the ticket man their mother was deathly ill, and that their aunt had called them back to the city to say a quick goodbye, before she passed from this life to the next. Oh, Kendra, such looks of sympathy they got then. The porter, whom they didn't need because of course they had no luggage, and the conductor, and everyone went out of their way to be kind to the poor girls, whose mother lay dying. So convincing was Emmy that she had to whisper several times to Julia while the train rumbled down its tracks, that she'd made it all up. Julia was nearly convinced Mum was on her deathbed, too. And when they stepped out of the tube at the station near their flat, you'd have thought Emmy had pulled off the greatest feat in modern history. That's how proud of herself she was.
Isabel laughs with more energy.
And all the while the greatest feat was actually happening already, as hundreds of Luftwaffe pilots climbed into their cockpits.
Her smile dies away slowly. Then she turns to me.
Did you know, Kendra, that the RAF pilots who saw the German bombers headed for the coast of England had never seen so many aircraft in the air all at the same time? Never had they seen the likes of it. Their coming was like a sheet of black across the sky. I can't even imagine.
I am at a complete loss for words, and already anxious about what she is preparing to tell me. It can't be anything good.
No, of course you can't. The radar station at Foreness was the first to pick them up, even as Emmy was making her way to Knightsbridge. Isn't that astonishing? Those planes were already in the air, already streaming toward London, as Emmy walked to her appointment, and no one had any idea.
Isabel seems to withdraw into a protected place, where the details of that 7th day of September are kept. She learned of these details after the fact, perhaps months later, maybe years later, and it appears that she filed them away, to bring them out now, with me.
There was all of London, going about its Saturday afternoon business. A WAAF corporal at the radar station was confused by the size of the formation on the radar screen, and she called for one of her superior officers. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. "What is that?" she probably said, pointing to the monstrous cloud on the screen. "Can't you just see her, Kendra?"
I nodded. I could see her. Then the Dover radar picked up the giant shadow, and then Rye. Isabel continues.
And oh, the chatter as they took to their radios to warn their brothers at arms that an armada from hell was streaking across the channel toward them.
She pauses for a moment. I can almost hear the throaty hum of all those engines. Isabel turns to the window as a breeze catches the lace and lifts it in our direction, almost in greeting. The laughter of a child outside wafts into the room.
It started on the south side of the Thames at about 4:30.
Her voice seems almost detached from her body.
Emmy was already finished with her meeting with Mr. Dabney when the sirens began to scream. And then everyone was running for shelter, and they heard the planes, and they felt the impact of what was happening at the docks. It was...
She stops and shakes her head as she struggles to find the right words.
It was as if the end of the world had begun. The end of everything.
Then Isabel slowly raises her head to look at me.
For a long time, Emmy wished it had been the end of the world. A very long time.
Part 2. Chapter 16. Emmy. When Emmy and Julia arrived at the flat, it was as if they had never left it. The 2.5 months they had been at Thistle House had seemed much longer until they stepped over the threshold, and then the days with Charlotte immediately took on the form of a prolonged dream. Everything seemed to whisper to Emmy that they had been gone only a day, everything except the evidence of Mum's lonely nights without them. The sitting-room sofa was a tumble of pillows, unfolded laundry, and scattered magazines. Teacups and biscuit wrappers lay about, as well as plates and bowls, with food remains clinging to them. A collection of nearly empty nail polish bottles was pushed together on the coffee table, looking like a tiny mob of dissidents.
"Mum is messy,"
Julia said as the girls made their way from the sitting area to the kitchen, which was just as unkempt as the front room.
"She misses us," Emmy said. "There's no one to clean the flat for without us here, that's all."
"I'm hungry."
Julia frowned at the bits of dried egg and toast on a plate on the kitchen table. Emmy checked her watch. It was just 1 o'clock. Plenty of time before she needed to be back on a train toward Knightsbridge. "Run some soapy water in the sink, and put Mum's breakfast dishes in it to soak," she said. "I'll see what there is to eat." Mum had little by way of food in the cupboards, but Emmy did see that there was 1/2 loaf of bread and 1 can of beans so that she could make Julia beans on toast. While the beans heated on the stove, the girls went about the flat, picking up the dishes Mum had strewn about and bringing them to the kitchen to soak. They also tidied up the sofa, put the laundry away, and straightened the magazines and newspapers. The truly empty nail polish bottles Emmy tossed into the bin. The couple with still a bit of polish inside them, she set on Mum's bureau, which she found to be also littered with papers, hosiery, hair combs, and handkerchiefs. Emmy sat Julia down with her lunch, and then went next door to see whether Thea was home. There was no answer at their neighbor's door. Back inside the flat, Emmy sat down next to Julia, who was halfway through her meal.
"Jules, Thea isn't home right now, so I need you to be a brave girl and wait here for Mum to get home from work. It won't be long." If you take a little nap, it will seem like no time at all. Then you can surprise her when she comes inside and sees you.
Julia licked bean juice off her fork.
Where are you going?
I have to be somewhere else this afternoon.
Julia looked down at her plate and poked a piece of toast with the tines of her fork.
Is this about the brides?
Yes.
Mum doesn't know where you're going, does she?
Emmy paused only a second.
No, not yet. This is our secret, yours and mine. I want to surprise her.
Surprise her with what?
Julia sounded skeptical. Emmy leaned forward in her chair, wanting Julia to catch her excitement.
When my bride's dresses are real, when people can buy them in stores, and women can wear them on their wedding day, she will be proud of me.
Julia swirled a cube of toast in the beans and then skewered it.
What time are you coming home?
The less Emmy said about that, the better.
I'm not sure.
Julia was thoughtful as she chewed, almost as if fitting something together in her head.
Mum's going to be cross with you.
Emmy rose from the chair and reached for the electric bill that was among the other pieces of opened mail on the kitchen counter. She pulled the bill out and brought the empty envelope and a pen back to the table.
At first, yes, she will probably be cross with me,
Emmy said as she sat back down. I'm going to write her a note.
When she gets home, you can make sure she sees it.
All right?
Julia nodded, but the doubt in her eyes was alarming. Emmy had always been able to sway Julia her way, on just about everything. But at that moment, Julia looked thoroughly unconvinced that Emmy was on the doorstep of her dreams.
You'll make sure Mum sees it, right?
Emmy said, this time with more force. Julia nodded slowly, a hundred little thoughts behind her unreadable expression. The nod wasn't good enough for Emmy.
Promise me you'll give it to her, Emmy pressed.
I promise,
Julia replied, without so much as a second's hesitation. Emmy could not spend the time to figure out what Julia was thinking. Her sister looked tired. Perhaps that was all her strange behavior was, the result of too little sleep the night before.
I'll write the note real quick, and then I'll get you tucked onto the sofa to wait for Mum, okay?
Okay.
Emmy uncapped the pen and turned the envelope over to its back side.
Mum, I had to come back to London to take care of something that matters a great deal to me. Julia insisted on coming with me. I had no plans to bring her, and I'm sorry if it makes you angry that I did. She misses you. Have no fear about taking her back to Thistle House if you want to. Mrs. Havelock is a very kind woman, and Julia likes it there. I don't know exactly when I will see you again. Please know that I'm doing exactly what you said I should do. You said wishing something doesn't make it come true. Doing it does. Someday I hope you will be proud of me. Emmy. She set the envelope against a teacup on the counter. Then she reached for Julia's plate and set it to soak with the other dirty dishes. When Emmy turned back to her sister, she offered Julia her hand, and she took it. They walked into the sitting room. Emmy arranged the pillows. Julia crawled up onto the cushions and lay down at once. The missed hours of sleep and the long morning of travel had caught up with her. Emmy smoothed Julia's hair away from her face, suddenly grieved that she wasn't sure when she would see her sister again. After the war, certainly. But how long would that be? If Mr. Dabney and his wife planned to evacuate her to the countryside, perhaps she could convince them to take Julia as well. But Thistle House was such a lovely place, and Julia had been so happy there. She didn't know the Dabneys at all. Emmy had no idea what to expect from them as foster parents. Indeed, she didn't care. She would suffer through any kind of parenting to be able to learn what Mr. Dabney could teach her. No, the best place for Julia for as long as the war lasted was with Charlotte. Emmy bent to kiss her forehead. Julia was already on the edge of sleep. Mum will be home in no time.
Okay,
Julia whispered,
Don't open the door to anyone unless you hear Thea come home, okay? Stay right here on the sofa. Emmy stood, and her sister did not move.
I love you, Jules.
But Julia was asleep. Now that Emmy could concentrate solely on herself, she realized how disheveled she probably looked. She went into Mum's room to borrow a dress that she hoped her mother wouldn't miss. She found one near the back. A red jersey knit, patterned in tiny geometric designs, and three-quarter sleeves. Mum had not worn it in a long while. As Emmy slipped out of her wrinkled dress to put on the fresh one, she figured out why. It was a bit snug, even on her. But it was 10 times better than what she had been wearing, and definitely a woman's dress. She smoothed her hair in her mother's mirror, using one of Mum's hair combs to tame her curls. Then she took her wrinkled dress, folded it, and went into Julia's in her room and laid it on her bed. Back in the front room, Emmy gave her sleeping sister one last peck on her forehead. Then she retrieved her satchel from where she had stowed it by the front door, and left the flat, putting the key back under the mat where she had found it. Knightsbridge was 2 miles away, a walkable distance, if Emmy had not already covered 5 miles that day and had more time. She made for the tube station, drawing no more stares from passers-by. Having Julia in tow had made them noticeable. Now that she was traveling alone, she knew she didn't look like a child, and she didn't feel like a child. She wasn't about a child's business. 20 minutes later, Emmy was at Knightsbridge Station, with plenty of time to find Cadogan Square. She consulted the wall map posted underground, and saw that the street she was looking for was only a half mile away. Emmy emerged from the station on Brompton Road and walked to Pavilion, passing walls of sandbags and signs for shelters. Above her, the barrage balloons, hovering soundless, threw weird shadows onto the sidewalk. Knightsbridge was a well-to-do area, very much like Mayfair, where Mum went to work every day. Emmy didn't know how well off Mrs. Crofton was. She had never mentioned to Emmy where she lived, but Mrs. Crofton's cousin apparently had money, or had married into wealth. As Emmy approached Cadogan, the residences became more and more elegant and stately. She found Mr. Dabney's home, a Georgian townhouse flanked on either side by half a dozen matching, 3-story, wedding-white homes. Each was flawlessly kept, with window boxes of flowers and ferns, and ocean-blue front doors that glistened in the late afternoon sun. She had 5 minutes to spare, but she didn't have the patience to stand outside and wait. Surely the Dabneys and Mrs. Crofton would find her punctuality an asset. Emmy could not stop her hand from shaking as she pressed the bell. The door was opened by a uniformed maid, not much older than Emmy. "I have an appointment with Mr. Dabney."
"My name's Emmeline Downtree."
Emmy's voice squeaked as she spoke her name. The maid swung the door wide.
"Please, won't you come in?"
Emmy followed her into a tiled entry. A golden chandelier hung from a tall ceiling. Potted ferns flanked a tall wardrobe, one of only 2 pieces of furniture in the foyer. A round, marble-topped table in the center of the room was the other. A vase of silver-pink roses adorned it.
"May I take your jacket?"
The maid cocked her head and held out her hand. It was a nice day outside. No one was wearing or carrying a jacket. Emmy handed it to her as her cheeks warmed.
"And your bag?"
Emmy's hand instinctively felt for the padded corners of the bride box inside her satchel.
"I'll keep this with me, thank you."
She nodded.
"Right this way, miss."
Emmy was shown to a sitting room that wasn't a great deal bigger than Mum's, but the furnishings could not have been more different. Chintz-covered sofas were arranged in the center of the room, on top of a thick rug in shades of mauve and russet. A marble fireplace graced one wall, a tea cart another, and an escritoire the last. Paintings of parks, woods, and rose gardens decorated the walls. French fashion magazines from before Paris fell were fanned out on the coffee table.
Emmy had never been in such a pretty room before, except on school field trips to royal residences and museums.
If you'd like to have a seat.
The maid motioned to the tableau of sofas, and Emmy sat down, grateful to be off her trembling legs. The maid left the room, and Emmy took several long breaths to quiet her nerves, reminding herself that she had been asked to come to this elegant room. She was invited here. Emmy reached into her satchel to remove the bride's box from the shawl she had wrapped it in, so that she would be ready to show Mr. Dabney the sketches. She pulled the bundle onto her lap and unfolded the layers of cloth. The careful work she had done to calm her anxious heart disintegrated in a blinding instant. Inside the shawl was Julia's book of fairy tales.
Chapter 17. For several seconds, Emmy could do nothing but stare at the book. Then she closed her eyes, willing the bride's box to be on her lap when she opened them, because surely, surely, what was inside the shawl was not Julia's book. It couldn't be. Couldn't be. Emmy opened her eyes slowly, and the book's honey-gold cover met her gaze. Julia. Julia! How could she have done such a thing? She knew there hadn't been room for her book in the satchel. She knew how important this day was to Emmy. She knew Emmy was meeting with someone who wanted to see the bride's box. She knew. And then the clarity slammed into Emmy. Of course Julia knew. That was why her behavior was so odd while she ate her lunch. She knew Emmy wouldn't be showing anyone her brides today. Emmy had said the day before that she had only this one chance with the brides. Julia had deduced that if this chance was eliminated, she would never have to worry about the bride's box parting them, ever. She knew Emmy would arrive at this meeting, thinking she had her brides, and would discover that she didn't. Emmy would have to leave the meeting. No brides, no meeting. No meeting, no parting. Emmy would have to come back to the flat, to her. Yes, Emmy would be livid, but she would have to come back to her. Julia knew where the bride's box was, and Emmy didn't. Julia hadn't been thirsty the night before at Thistle House, when she sent Emmy downstairs for a drink of water. She had needed a few minutes to remove the bride's box, wrap her fairy tale book in the shawl, and stuff it into the satchel. The bride's box had no doubt been shoved under the bed as Emmy climbed the stairs with her cup. It all made perfect sense. Julia never wanted to leave Thistle House, and she hadn't wanted Emmy to either. Emmy would now have to take her back to Charlotte's if she wanted her bride's return to her. Upon their return, Charlotte would surely be vigilant so as not to let the girls out of her sight again. Emmy wouldn't be allowed any more solo trips to town. She wouldn't be allowed solo trips anywhere. Julia had concocted a brilliant plan. Emmy wondered if she even knew how brilliant it was. She heard voices from outside the room. One was Mrs. Crofton's. Emmy had no sketches to show Mr. Dabney, and no way of getting them back without returning to Thistle House. The room suddenly felt very warm. A ribbon of sweat dampened her forehead as Emmy hammered her brain to think of an excuse for coming to the meeting without the designs. Emmy could think of nothing. The sketches were the reason she was there. It would be ridiculous to say she had forgotten them, and unthinkable to say she had purposely left them behind. The door opened, and Emmy rose to her feet. Mrs. Crofton came into the room, followed by a man and a woman who looked to be in their late 50s. The man had a groomed goatee and wire-rimmed spectacles, and he wore a gray striped suit. The woman wore a pale yellow chiffon dress, with a dropped waist and lace sleeves. Her hair was as black as night, his pearl gray and brown. "Emmeline, how good to see you again." Mrs. Crofton crossed the room and clasped Emmy's hands with hers. "I am so glad you could come. May I introduce my cousin and his wife, Graham and Madeline Dabney?" The couple came forward to shake Emmy's hand. Mr. Dabney's grip was firm and warm, Mrs. Dabney soft and cool. Both smiled politely and said how pleased they were to meet her.
I'm so very happy to meet you both as well.
Emmy's voice sounded strange in her ears.
Please, have a seat.
Mr. Dabney motioned to the sofa as he and his wife sat down opposite her. Mrs. Crofton sat on a third sofa, the smallest of the three. The young woman who had answered the bell came into the room with a tea tray as they took their seats. She set it down on the table in the middle and poured tea into four bone china cups.
So, Miss Downtree,
Mr. Dabney began, stirring sugar into his teacup.
I hear you hope to have your own line of wedding dresses some day. Perhaps one day your own boutique.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, I do.
Emmy's cup trembled on its saucer. She took a sip to stop it, even though the liquid burned her mouth.
Tell me how you came to have such a vision for your future.
Emmy set the cup back on its saucer and placed it on the table to free herself of having to hold it steady.
I have always been drawn to women's fashions, dresses especially. The more elegant the dress, the better. I don't know of a more beautiful and elegant concept of a gown than a wedding dress. They are so flawless. I quite agree with you there, Emmeline,
Mrs. Crofton said as she looked at her wristwatch.
So do you know how much longer it will be before your mother arrives?
The pleasantries regarding why Emmy loved drawing wedding gowns had been to fill the time while they waited for Mum to join them. Emmy swallowed back a bolt of panic.
Well, she is working today, actually. But I, thought I'd see what kind of situation you are proposing. And then I can present it to her, when she gets off work.
Oh.
Mrs. Crofton looked to her cousin. Mr. Dabney's mouth became a thin line.
I had rather we took care of this in one meeting, Miss Downtree,
he said politely, but with authority. We are leaving London on Tuesday.
What my wife and I are proposing will require your mother's approval.
Well, my mother, looks upon me as an adult, you see, so I am able to make my own decisions regarding my future as a designer.
Mr. Dabney smiled. It was a grin that made Emmy uneasy. He had found what she had just said amusing, not enlightening.
To be sure, but still, you are just 15, Miss Downtree.
Emmy nodded.
Then you can see that Mrs. Dabney and I must have your mother's permission to take you under our wing, so to speak. Did my cousin tell you what I am proposing?
I only hinted at it, Graham, Mrs. Crofton interjected. I wrote the letter in a hurry and told her we'd explain it all when she got here.
Ah.
Mr. Dabney leaned forward and sandwiched his hands together, the pose of a man about to broker a deal.
Eloise sent me your two sketches, and she told me that you've had no formal training, either in designing or sewing. That is what most interested me. The sketches I saw were surprisingly good, considering. That you created them with no training is most remarkable. I am eager to see the rest of your designs. If I'm not mistaken, it would appear that you have an innate gift, Miss Downtree.
Emmy's heart took a stutter step, and she forced herself to say calmly, Thank you, Mr. Dabney.
Now, it's been my practice to employ an apprentice or two in my studio throughout the year. I design costumes for theatrical productions here in the West End and elsewhere in Britain and North America. I like to do my part in encouraging the up-and-coming young designers, and I teach them while they help me construct my costumes. I believe Eloise has told you this.
Yes.
When my cousin saw your sketches, she too was impressed with your untrained eye for design, which is why she sent me those two sketches. She thought I might wish to consider offering you an apprenticeship.
Yes, I told her that,
Mrs. Crofton said, offering Emmy a reassuring smile that wordlessly said all was going well and that Emmy didn't need to be so nervous.
Now, Mrs. Dabney and I wish to do our part in the war effort, you see. Eloise tells me you have been evacuated to Gloucestershire and have spent the last few months there?
Yes, that's correct.
Emmy could scarcely breathe.
What was she going to tell him about not having the sketches?
Graham Dabney nodded to his wife, who smiled at him. Mrs. Dabney and I have discussed taking in a London evacuee. It occurred to me that, depending on the strength of the rest of your designs, we might offer to take you with us on Tuesday to my wife's estate outside Edinburgh. That way, I could teach you about dress construction, pattern making, all that, and while you learn, you can assist me in the creation of a series of costumes for a production of La Boheme in Boston. I think you would find the work as entertaining as it would be educational. The gowns for La Boheme are quite impressive.
Emmy swallowed hard. The strength of the rest of my designs?
Mr. Dabney sat back, distancing himself a little from her. Yes, of course. It would be unkind of me to bring you on as an apprentice, if you have not the natural talent that I am hoping you have. I already know you do not have the sewing experience. You would have to have one of the two.
He laughed lightly, expecting Emmy would also.
Mrs. Crofton offered a half-chuckle, surely meant to keep the conversation light.
I think you'll be quite satisfied with the rest of her work, Graham. Perhaps now would be a good time to show us the rest of your sketches, Emmeline.
Emmy looked from Mrs. Crofton to Mr. Graham, and to his lovely but obviously shy wife. Which of them could she appeal to?
Emmeline?
Mrs. Crofton said. Emmy closed her eyes as the truth, the only thing she could think to say, bubbled out of her.
I don't have them with me today.
Did you not tell her to bring them?
Emmy could hear the disapproval in Graham Dabney's voice as he addressed his cousin.
Of course I did, was Mrs. Crofton's quick reply.
Emmeline?
Emmy opened her eyes to look at her.
Why didn't you bring them?
Please, God, let the truth be enough, she prayed to the Almighty.
I had them in this satchel, inside the box I carry them in. My sister, she's only 7, was worried that she might not see me again if I went to this meeting, and then became your apprentice. She substituted her fairy tale book for the box.
She lifted the book out of the bag and placed it on her lap.
I just now discovered this, as I heard your voices outside the door. I'm so very sorry. She's only a child. I promise I can get the sketches back. If you would allow me a couple of days to retrieve them.
A couple of days? Mrs. Crofton echoed. The other two adults stared at Emmy, apparently still trying to absorb what she had said.
My sister made the switch when we were still in Gloucestershire. I need to travel back to the house where we've been living and get them.
Mr. Dabney still seemed to be processing Emmy's excuse. But we are closing up this house and leaving on Tuesday.
Please, Emmy pleaded. Just give me tomorrow to return to Gloucestershire and get them. I can be here on Monday to show them to you.
With your mother, Mr. Dabney replied. There is no point in returning on Monday without your mother. I do not wish to be arrested for kidnapping.
Graham, dear.
Mrs. Dabney touched her husband's arm, but her eyes were on Emmy. The woman could obviously see the turmoil that was raging inside her.
Madeline, we cannot take a 15-year-old girl to Scotland without her mother's permission.
Of course we can't.
Mrs. Dabney offered Emmy as compassionate a look as someone could.
Do go retrieve your sketches, Miss Downtree, and come back Monday at the same hour with your mum.
She turned to her husband.
That will work, won't it, Graham? We've a lot of arrangements to make.
But I suppose it can, yes.
But you must remember, Miss Downtree.
I cannot take you with us unless I see the rest of your sketches. The work will be too daunting for you if you've no natural flair for it. I must be convinced you have it. It would not be good for either one of us if you don't.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Emmy said, not much louder than a whisper. She felt on the edge of bursting into tears, and she did not want even one tiny drop to find its way out of either eye. Emmy stood, so that she could take her leave. She had an enormous task ahead of her. The others stood, too, Emmy shoved the fairy tale book inside the satchel.
I'm so sorry to have wasted your time today, Mr. Dabney.
Mrs. Crofton reached out a hand to touch Emmy's arm.
It's not entirely your fault, Emmeline. You didn't know your sister switched out the box with her book at the last minute.
Emmy was certain Mrs. Crofton said this for her cousin's sake. It was becoming clear to Emmy that Graham Dabney was not one to overlook shortcomings. He demanded excellence, which was exactly what Emmy needed and wanted in a mentor. She could not risk disappointing him again.
I wouldn't say it was a complete waste of time, Miss Dantry, but we leave on Tuesday. It's already been arranged.
I will be here with my mother on Monday at 4 o'clock, I promise.
Emmy had not wanted to involve Mum at all, but now everything had changed. She desperately needed her. Not only did she need Mum to come with her to the next meeting with the Dabneys, Emmy needed Mum to accompany her to Thistle House on Sunday, so that they could take Julia back and retrieve the bride's box. And it was imperative that she return with Mum, so that she could keep her word and be at Cadogan Square at 4 o'clock on Monday. Only Mum could make that happen. Surely Emmy could convince Mum, a woman whose own dreams had been cruelly warped by circumstances she hadn't orchestrated, to let her go with the Dabneys to Scotland. Surely Mum would be able to see Emmy had the opportunity to become more than the illegitimate child who had stolen Mum's life away from her. Emmy could become a creator of beautiful things. She could be someone Mum was proud of, instead of what Emmy currently was, a constant reminder of whatever plans she had had for her life had ended when Emmy was born. Emmy really did want Mum to be proud of her. She had to find a way to persuade Mum to help her. I'll show you to the door, Emmeline, Mrs. Crofton said. After retrieving her jacket, they walked to the front door without saying a word. When Mrs. Crofton opened it, she reached for Emmy's arm. Make sure you have your sketches when you return, Emmeline, she said softly. I can't stress it enough. Graham is very good at what he does, but he's also very demanding. And your mother must give her permission. Whatever differences you and your mother have, you must lay them aside. She has to come with you.
I understand, Emmy whispered back. Thank you. Thank you for making this happen.
Mrs. Crofton squeezed Emmy's arm. I don't have any other family besides Graham. I want you to go as far as you can, Emmeline. I really do. You will always have a place at Primrose. Emmy hugged her, grateful beyond words. When she pulled away, Mrs. Crofton's eyes were shimmering. See you Monday. The door closed behind her, and Emmy took off down the street. Chapter 18. Emmy rushed as quickly as her legs could take her back to Knightsbridge Station, and then sailed down the stairs to the train tracks. It was just a few minutes before 4:30. If a train came quickly, she could be at Oxford Circus Station within 10 minutes. She would have to run to Mrs. Billingsley's home a few blocks away to catch Mum before she left at 5 o'clock. But she had to try. Emmy knew if she caught Mum as she was getting off work, she could prepare her for coming home to Julia on her sofa. She could also use the time they would be together in public transit to appeal to her. Mum's main reason for Emmy's accompanying Julia to Gloucestershire in the evacuation was to make sure Julia didn't end up in a terrible placement with ogres for caregivers. Mum had nothing to worry about now. Charlotte was every inch the ideal foster mother. There was no reason for Mum to decline the Dabney's kind offer except for spite. Mum had her flaws, but malice was not one of them. If Emmy could get her to agree, then perhaps a few years down the road, when the war was long over, Emmy's gowns would be hanging in a lovely boutique. She would have the money to get Mum out of whatever degrading situation she was trapped in. Emmy could get them all a nice flat on a quiet street, and Mum wouldn't have to be a kitchen maid anymore. She could work in the boutique with Emmy. Julia could, too. The three of them would be surrounded by lace and loveliness, and happy young women shopping for the day when they would look and feel like princesses.
These thoughts propelled Emmy as she switched trains for the Oxford Circus Station and then sprinted for Mrs. Billingsley's home off Regent Street. She had been to the home only once before. The previous Christmas, Mrs. Billingsley had invited her staff for a tea party on Boxing Day. Instead of serving, Mum got to sit in the parlour while hired hands poured tea and passed around platters of sweets and sandwiches. Emmy wasn't entirely sure she could find the house again, but she would ring the bell on every doorstep on the block before she'd give up. When she turned the corner onto Regent Street, Emmy scanned the homes, at once certain that the glistening grey mansion with ironwork on every window halfway down the block was Mrs. Billingsley's. Relief flooded her. It was 5:20, plenty of time. Emmy rang the bell and waited, using the seconds to catch her breath. The door was opened by a woman Emmy had met on Boxing Day, nearly 9 months before. She remembered the woman's name was Gladys. She seemed quite surprised to see Emmy.
"Hello, I'm Emmeline Dantree," Emmy said. "I am wondering if I might wait for my mother, Annie Dantree, to get off work." "Oh my gracious, is everything all right? I thought you and your little sister had been sent to the countryside."
Emmy's breath still came in ragged swells.
"No, yes, I mean, yes, everything is all right. We just had to make a trip into London today, to take care of a few errands. May I wait for her, please?" "I'm afraid she went home early today. Are you sure you're all right? She's left already."
Emmy's rapidly beating heart did a somersault. Of all the days Mum had to leave early, it had to be today.
"Yes, I'm afraid so. She left at 4. Maybe even before. I think she..."
But Gladys didn't finish her sentence. Sirens suddenly pierced the air. The sirens never sounded during the day, and so the two stood there, dumbfounded for a moment, as if they had no idea what the strange keening meant. The Luftwaffe didn't fly during the day, when anti-aircraft guns could pick the planes off. The Luftwaffe flew at night, using darkness as a cover. Yet the sirens wailed.
"What the devil?"
But Gladys's words were cut short by a series of loud booms that punched the air somewhere in the distance. Both women turned toward the sound, and then there were more thundering wallops. Smoke began to rise from the direction of the Thames, south and east of where they stood. Several seconds passed before Emmy realized the sounds she was hearing were bombs, dropped in daylight. As she processed this knowledge, more bombs fell. Gladys reached for her.
"Come inside, dear. We've a cellar."
Emmy instinctively stepped back from her grasp.
"I have to get home."
Emmy turned from her, even as Gladys yelled for her to come back.
"You can't leave now,"
the woman shouted. But Emmy was already off the doorstep, out the gate, and then running back the way she had come. And all the while the sirens kept wailing. The horizon ahead kept filling with smoke, and a cacophony of explosions kept rocking the air in the distance. She could no longer hear Gladys bellowing for her to return. She was only barely aware of the other people on the sidewalk, who, like her, were rushing to be somewhere. Emmy's sole focus was getting on a train headed southeast toward home. Emmy rounded a corner and nearly ran into a man coming from the opposite direction. They skipped the courtesies due each other and kept charging ahead. Emmy could see the steps to the underground. As she closed the distance, she heard herself saying aloud,
"Thank God, thank God, thank God."
Thank God Mum had left early. A few moments earlier, Emmy had been perturbed that Mum wasn't at Mrs. Billingsley's, and now she was nearly crying with relief that she had gone home at 4. That meant Julia wasn't alone. Thank God Julia wasn't alone. People were cramming themselves onto the steps of the station to get below ground. Emmy pushed her way forward down the stairs to get on a train. Surely one or two were still running. The sirens had been wailing for only 10 minutes. She pressed her way to the tracks, surrounded on all sides by women with shopping bags, men with briefcases, grocers and bus drivers, wardens and waitresses, bankers and beggars. She could feel the incoming rush of air as a train approached, and the people moved forward as one, crushing her to the wall so that she could not take a step toward it. As soon as the train slowed to a stop, the people inside the station were at its doors. When they slid open, a few of the people on the train attempted to disembark.
"What's happened?"
one of them yelled.
"There's an air raid!"
someone in the crowd shouted back.
"The Luftwaffe is attacking the East End! The whole bloody sky is filling with smoke!"
Some got off the train. Some stayed on. Others boarded until there was no more room. Emmy could not make her way forward to be among those who got on. It didn't matter, though, because the train didn't move after that. She turned around and pressed through the crowd to get back to the stairs, but there was no way to ease or push her way through. The station was full of people, elbow to elbow, and outside she could still hear the wail of the sirens, the thunder of explosives, the crackling of anti-aircraft guns, and even the buzzing hum of planes.
"What's your name?"
a woman said. She was clutching a little dog to her chest. Her hair had worked itself free of its pins and spilled about her shoulders in a wacky, unkempt tumble.
"Emmeline." "I'm Mrs. Grote. Do you live around here?"
"Whitechapel." A muted boom punctured the sheltered air inside, and Mrs. Grote jumped, knocking herself into Emmy.
"So sorry,"
she said as she righted herself.
"I am not good with loud noises. Percy doesn't like them either. Do you, Percy? Oh, I am so glad I was walking my dog when the siren started,"
she said, now sniffling into the scruff of the dog's neck.
"I'm so glad. He'd be home alone if I had gone to the market instead. Can you imagine?"
Emmy wanted to get away from Mrs. Grote and her dog and her chatty demeanor, but there was nowhere to go. There was nowhere for any of them to go. The people in the station could only lean against one another and wait for the thrashing outside to stop and the sirens to fall silent. For more than an hour, Emmy hunkered in the station, listening to the muffled sounds of a battle raging above. Finally, a few minutes after 6, the world outside grew quiet compared to what it had been before. The crowd of people waited expectantly for the all-clear signal, but did not hear it. After several minutes, a few people began to venture out anyway, despite a warning by a civil defense official, who had dashed inside with them that no one should leave until the all-clear signal. Following those who pushed past, Emmy emerged back onto the street. The sky to the east was a bright blaze of gold and gray. The barrage blooms that hovered in the distance looked pink in the strange light of smoke and fire. Emmy didn't want anyone asking her any more questions about who she was or where she lived. She didn't care if the all-clear hadn't sounded, and the Germans were merely circling to come back and have at them again. All she knew was the flat was in the direction of the fires and smoke. She had to get home to Mum and Julia. She took off on foot, as at last the all-clear sounded. She wasn't sure where she was, until she saw a landmark sign for St. Paul's 2 miles away. If she could find St. Paul's, she could find her way home. Others who had been sheltered and wished to be home, or at least somewhere else, were also on the streets. Emmy could hear snippets of their conversations. Someone had been listening to a radio. Fires at the docks were raging. Warehouses were engulfed in flames. Stores, houses, churches, and schools all across the East End were demolished, damaged, or burning. Emmy turned to a man who said it was most severe by Tower Bridge.
"Which neighborhoods? Which streets?"
she asked him. He shook his head.
"I don't know, love. All over. Look at the sky."
He nodded toward the direction they were headed. The rosy orange hue seemed to suggest the earth had swung off its orbit, and now the sun was preparing to set in the east. The long walk to the Morton train station that morning seemed like a lifetime ago, as Emmy dodged her way closer and closer to home in the sickly hued twilight. She knew from Mum that it was 3 miles from the flat to Mrs. Billingsley's in Mayfair. She tried to hail a taxi, but none of them stopped for her. Everyone and everything moved at a frenzied pace, as emergency vehicles raced to the east end, and survivors made their way west. When Emmy could see the dome of St. Paul's, she knew she was two-thirds of the way home, just a mile to go. And then the sirens came again, louder this time. Or maybe it was just that she so desperately did not want to hear them. Anti-aircraft guns began peppering the sky over the river. She felt the drone of the approaching planes in her chest. The scattering of people searching for cover erupted all around her, but she did not join them. Emmy doubled her pace for home, despite her weariness. "Run! Run!" Someone shouted. Emmy heard a whistle, almost like a flute, and then the sound became an orchestra of angry flutes. Then there was a shattering whack. Her feet were off the ground, and Emmy marveled for a split second at the weightless sensation of flying. And then her head slammed against bricks, and the world went silent and dark. Chapter 19.
I'm so thirsty.
This was Emmy's first thought when the darkness lifted. She heard a woman singing softly, a lullaby. Emmy was not alone. A trio of booms echoed from somewhere far above her. She smelled ash and dirt and sulfur. Something cool and wet touched her forehead, and she opened her eyes.
"There now,"
a woman said as she held the compress to Emmy's head.
"You're all right. You're safe."
Emmy looked about her and saw nothing but shadows and the dim outlines of men and women crouched like stowaways in the hold of a ship. She was lying on a cot. Her head pounded and her ankle throbbed. A whistling sound, faint but recognizable from the last moment she remembered, split the quiet. And Emmy half rose with a start before the woman gently pressed her back down on the cot.
"Not to worry. You're safe here."
"Where am I?"
Emmy croaked.
"What happened?"
"You're in a shelter, love. You're safe. You were knocked out cold, but a fireman brought you here. You're safe now."
For several seconds, Emmy could not make sense of this information. All she could remember was that she had been on the street, and then there were sirens, and the angry flutes.
What day is it?"
"It's still Saturday, love. What's your name?"
"Emmeline. Where am I?"
"You're in the basement at St. Paul's. What's your last name, Emmeline?"
Emmy ignored her question. She had to think for a moment. She had been on her way home.
Home.
She was walking home. She had the satchel in her hand. She was walking home.
Home.
Julia and Mum. Emmy bolted upright and her head spun.
"Hold on there, Emmeline. You've a nasty bump on your head. Let's take it easy now."
"I have to go."
A wave of dizziness swept over Emmy, and her upper body fell against the woman. She lowered Emmy back down.
"You can't go back out, Emmeline. It's dangerous. There are bombs falling everywhere."
As if to prove her point, several booms pounded outside, and the room shook.
"They're going to kill us all,"
a man shouted.
"Hush now,"
the woman yelled back at him.
"But my mother and sister,"
Emmy pleaded. The woman's eyes narrowed in concern.
"Were they on the street with you?"
"No, they're at home. I was on my way to them."
She patted Emmy's arm.
"They are surely in a shelter too, Emmeline, just like you. They want you to stay safe. You can't go out there now."
"It's bloody Armageddon,"
another man said, sounding terrified. The woman who was singing softly nearby stopped for a second and told the man to shut up. A child whimpered,